I don't think we should start with anything else, but what was the most profound news over the last week, which was the Swiggy IPO that was long awaited. I think one of the seminal moments in our startup ecosystem to see a $1 billion plus IPO at a Decacon plus valuation go through successfully, list successfully on exchanges, and just create so much impact around.
What is interesting is for me is that, okay, what does it take 8 quarters out from here for Swiggy to win, or how does it look? What are the leading indicators of that? That, you know, if this is a successful IPO now, because this is an interesting one where there is a clear duopoly and there are these emerging segments of quick commerce which are playing out. So how does that play out is very interesting. And both companies operate in a very different way, right? One is very founder-led and has seen the resilience of, you know, going through the IPO, acquiring a company and then integrating it and having built senior management teams again and again. So one has done it, second is trying to do it, very different DNAs, you know, from that point of view. So it is going to be very interesting from that point of view. That's what is at least exciting for me.
Swiggy announced its Q2 results, the first results that it announced after the IPO. Everyone was waiting for them, primarily because in the last 1 year, I think there have been a lot of exciting numbers and market shares thrown here and there. And as Harsha keeps saying that it's unfair to compare a publicly listed company whose numbers are validated and shared with the stock exchanges as well as the broader shareholders versus a privately run company where at least people believe that there could be different ways of reporting numbers and comparisons being thrown in. So it was super exciting to see now all the numbers of Swiggy as well as Zomato being publicly available in the stock exchanges. And we thought, who better than to get Darshit and sort of get a deep dive into what does the Q2 result show us? Where do we think we are headed in terms of food delivery, quick commerce? What was noise? What was good PR? And what is the reality? Is something that we are excited to learn.
Yeah, I think I'll just go with my key takeaways from the results. In my view, I think the most exciting thing about this quarter's result for both Zomato and Swiggy is that quick commerce continues to grow, right? If you look at, in fact, Swiggy's quick commerce continue to grow at much faster pace compared to last quarter. They have almost grown 76% year on year, which is amazing, right? So if I just project this out, I feel that quick commerce will be a larger business than food business for both of them probably a year out from now, right? And that is amazing, right? So that's the first big takeaway for me, actually, personally. In terms of the market share, it seems like it's a status quo that Zomato is, 1.8x of Swiggy, and that continues to be the case in quick commerce. And similarly, in the food also, the market share continues to be on a status quo. I think what is interesting to me is the adjusted EBITDA of quick commerce business for both Instamart and Blinkit, which is vastly different, right? So if you look at the adjusted EBITDA as a percentage of revenue, Blinkit is almost break-even, whereas Swiggy is minus 70%. And that tells you that Blinkit has a lot of lead in terms of the capital efficiency around this business. So those are at least some of my key takeaways, but would love to hear how you guys think about the results.
I spoke to a few people. There seems to be an interesting trend. Zomato had tried 10-minute delivery and then said that this won't work. This was about a year and a half back. Swiggy Bolt, which is a 10-minute delivery, a few restaurant partners I have spoken to off the record have said that wherever they have their restaurant live, and they have Bolt also live, which is 10-minute delivery, and they have their full menu, which is a limited menu, and their full menu, the number of orders on Bolt is almost 15 to 20% already of all the orders that they get in that particular catchment. So it seems real that the 10-minute excitement that took over retail and grocery may actually even translate to food. People will swing.
What they are doing differently is like Flipkart minutes, wherein you scroll the entire catalog and whatever is available in like 15 minutes showed as Flipkart minutes. It's not a separate one.
I don't think
I've seen on Swiggy, there is a whole section. And now on this also, I saw, for example, on one of the dishes that this is qualified. I think so.
What was very interesting to see for me over the last 1 year or so, and the most critical topic that we at least saw happening in this week, was Zepto raising $350 million from domestic investors. That's a lot of money that's being deployed by family offices, etc. in India now. That pool of capital always existed, but we didn't know that there was so much quantum. And if you look back, Swiggy pre-IPO, FirstCry pre-IPO, there was so much domestic capital that has been now poured into growth stage startups, late stage startups, largely. But, you know, you knew that pre-IPO rounds would get a lot of domestic capital, but Zepto would be 18 to 24 months away from potentially an IPO. Maybe we'll get surprised that it'll happen in 12 months, but it's a risk asset as such. And for Indian domestic capital, from family offices to actually do such a large investment into a risk asset is something that's very heartwarming to see. Why is it heartwarming? Because fundamentally, the IRR expectations would be very, very different compared to a foreign private investor. Maybe Chiral, you can show the chart that you were discussing before. It would just fundamentally align, I think, new age entrepreneurs if this pool of capital keeps growing. So I think this is a great chart. Maybe Chiral, you can take us through it.
We were just compiling yet, you know, what you were saying, that if return expectations of a foreign fund is much, much higher than, let's say, a return expectation of an Indian family office. Why is that there? And then what does it mean for the ecosystem if that capital, what we are seeing in Zepto and then Swiggy, if that capital is starting to flow in? You were just doing some maths. It looks like that Indian family offices should be closer to $300 billion, right?
I mean, I think the AUM has grown phenomenally in the last 5 years because of the capital markets as well. Because I think 80-90% of the family office would be deployed in Indian domestic capital markets, which has just phenomenally given great returns. I think they would have CAGR'd 25-30% in the last 5 years, and the size has just ballooned significantly.
Correct. And, you know, the way at least I would look at it is, let's say, you know, any large corporate would be able to raise debt at like a very fine bank cost and hence, you know, will have a very lower IRR expectation against a international investor. International investor would also want to cover for the currency depreciation over time. So there are natural advantages of, you know, somebody in India who's or raising money from domestic capital. One, it has lower expectations in terms of returns. Two, what is mentioned here from a duration point of view, you don't have a fixed 8+2. It is kind of evergreen in nature. My sense is they do understand India also deeply. So their guidance in terms of what works in India, what kind of revenue pools are available, you know, foreign investors would always give us some inspiration that, okay, this has worked in a developed economy. But I think India, of course, throws up like newer things, you know. So at least this table highlights that, you know, what is happening. If that sustains, it means that domestic capital could be a real legit pool availability, which Indian entrepreneurs could use over time. I think this allocation is increasing. We don't have any numbers in terms of, okay, is this percentage on percentage, year on year increasing? It looks anecdotally, with the way pre-IPO participations are happening, that it's increasing. I think it's going to come down to growth stage equity as well. I'm hearing that, you know, $5-10 million from a family office is much easier these days as it was like 3 years ago. So all of that is getting available.
We are today discussing Vishal Megamart, which got listed yesterday. Listed, started, the IPO was at 33,000 crores, again got a pop. Now it's trading at 50,000 crores as a market cap. Let's go through some of these numbers quickly. You know, this is last year, 9,000 crores of revenue, now trending 10,000 crores plus in FY25. From a gross profit point of view, you know, and look at the growth. It's like 60% growth over the last 2 years, which has happened in a business which is predominantly or like 100% offline and is dependent on growth in that sector as well as new stores coming up. We'll come to, you know, understanding this kind of business in detail. Look at gross profit. I think gross profit is around 27-28%, quite steady. And steadily, you know, as revenue scaling, that's like continues to be onward on a good path. EBITDA margins, you know, 14-odd%, stable, looks like an efficient supply chain in place, efficient, you know, store operations in place, which is there. And the most, I think, fascinating is while the numbers from PAT point of view are have moved from 4-5%, look at the absolute amount. 2,000 crores of profit has become 4,600 crores profit. I think this year they're going to end around 5,200-5,300 crores of profit, right? So, you know, I was just doing broad maths from a ROCE point of view. This is like a 50% plus business. Fantastic.
461
business.
Hai na?
More context so that this become numbers become real. DMart is of course higher in terms of revenue. Let's say Jubilant Foodworks is around 5,000 crores revenue.
Yeah.
Right, so just for context, Page Industries is 5,000 crores revenue.
But branded revenue...
What's your sense? My sense is India has less than 200 companies which are greater than 50,000 crore market cap. Right, so it's like a... In my view, it's like a crown jewel company. It might not be the TCSs of the world, but I think it's a fantastic business.
I think my at least Twitter timeline or sorry, X timeline is now filled with the most important news that came out yesterday, which is the GDP numbers for the last quarter. And I think we've been hearing this from a lot of quarters that demand has slowed down, consumption has slowed down, etc. But I think the numbers sort of plummeting every quarter for the last four quarters seems to be now quite... concerning to see. Would love to sort of get a deep dive as to why this is happening and what's the next steps going to be. So if you see the last four quarters, isn't it concerning that, I mean, it seems to be quite consistently dropping, right? It doesn't seem to be a one-off. What was more interesting for me to see in this was, like, you know, when we look at our GDP, 65% is consumption-led. And there seems to be a stark drop more around that, because there's manufacturing drop, there's consumption drop. What has sustained is actually the government expenditure.
Spending.
Yeah, government spending. And I think US saw a similar thing in the last couple of years, right? Where government spending technically was, whatever growth was coming in the GDP was largely because of government spending. And if you remove government spending, actually they had negative GDP. So if you remove the government spending part, is that a fair way to look at it, Asi? That, you know, government expenditure is artificially propping up the GDP as well?
So see, the GDP comprises of three or four components. One is the private consumption. Second is the government consumption. Third is domestic investments, and fourth is net exports, exports minus imports, you know, net exports. So if you look in India's case, what has happened over the last few years consistently, and this has been a trend before COVID as well, that you had a private consumption that was steady. Government consumption was what was really driving growth over the last decade. You know, we have seen that corporate capex has come down completely. So there's been very little brownfield, greenfield investments. And we have been largely reliant on private consumption to move the needle up. And then exports haven't really moved much, but imports have come off, you know. So if effectively the net export by minus import, we are still on the way balanced. So effectively, you know, what is happening is that of all the components that are there, and the fourth component is private savings, that also has come off of late. So you know, when you add all the components together, 65%, you know, domestic consumption is what has been driving the economy, and that's slowing down. Is a matter of great concern. Now, I mean, 70% of iPhones sold in India are on debt. This is not anywhere in the world, you know, does this happen. So the problem is that, you know, we are living out of tomorrow's income. And that has created this situation where the Indian consumer now, you know, is fairly levered. Now, when this situation happens, effectively, your ability to consume drops. So, you know, you will ultimately cut down. You'll have to pay your past EMIs. You'll have to cut down. Secondly, the what is not appreciated much is the amount of impact that the interest rate increase has had on the Indian consumer. So that 250 basis point repo increase that was done post-COVID. I mean, to give you a context, if you take a if you had a 20 lakh home loan and you know for a 40 lakh home loan for 20 years, you know, and a 2.5% increase will basically mean that to keep the EMI same, your loan will go from 20 years to almost 32 to 33 years. I mean, just imagine the impact, you know, that this would have. So what it would basically mean is that your interest and outgo would go up from 35 lakhs, what it would have originally been, to almost about 79 to 80 lakhs of interest outgo that you would pay. And if the EMI increases, the EMI increases by almost 40%. So both ways, the pain is high. So I know, and in India, the real challenge is that most of our debt is high interest rate and low tenure. When tenures are long, the DSCR impact is lesser. DSCR impact becomes much higher when tenures, you know, come down. So effect to sum it up, you know, we have a situation where debt-fueled growth, the debt-fueled consumption growth has now reached its maximum limit. Government spending has now reached its maximum limit. So from here, incomes need to rise, which is a very, very painful thing.
If LickPref is getting activated, that means that the valuation is not a slam dunk. It's basically a valuation which is kind of in the middle, right? So in the case of Unacademy, there are definitely investors that have invested at, let's say, $30, $40 million also, like the Series A guys, for whom an $800 million outcome may be great from a valuation multiplier standpoint, but definitely not from a LickPref standpoint or from a dilutive standpoint, right? So I think what happens is if the valuation is suddenly becomes questioned, then everyone starts thinking about themselves. Like, what am I going to make? Or what does this mean for me? And then it doesn't become about the company anymore. It doesn't become about what's right for the company. Is that the right home for the company? Or is that? And I have noticed this a lot, that everyone has like the same company with the same metric. The board has gotten all the same information, same facts, but belief in the company can vary hugely. So for some investors, they'll be like, boss, the trajectory is downhill. Abhi 800 million ka mil raha hai, let's say, kal 400 bhi nahi mil sakta. Like, this is a great deal, take it, because boss, you know, I don't know whether, and sometimes, you know, the early guy, sometimes founders, like, I can put myself in a situation where I'll be like, boss, this is too undervalued. We'll definitely build this out. There's no point selling cheap, right? And everyone has a different point of view with the same information in the same company. And then that's why these situations become complicated discussions. Revanth, you have been a VC, so I'm sure you have.
I think in these cases, largely more. it largely relies on founder comfort and management team comfort. Agar founder mein jaan hai, CEO mein jaan hai, like they want to fight it out and say ki nahi yaar, let's continue to build. We will get through this phase. There is no reason for people to push a deal through. Usually these things will happen investors by design never want. I mean, these terms exist for downside protection, but in the end, nobody wants to see that, oh, I got 80 cents on the dollar and therefore, yeah, chalo, main toh bach gaya karke. Yes, it's an eventual outcome if the company doesn't do well, but given a choice, they would always want to feel that, yeah, let's wait 2 years, maybe we'll get a 2x on that, because that money is already deployed, right? Like, you also understand how fund cycles work. If I've deployed from a fund that was 5 years old, I can't redeploy that money. I have to anyway return it to LPs. So if there is a chance for me to wait for 4 more years and make a 2x on it, it's still better outcome than taking 80 cents on the dollar. But I will only do that if I believe objectively that the founder and the management team is really kicked about saying, ki nahi boss, fight karte hain. This is a tough phase. Let's just keep building. Let's keep building. We will grow revenue. Let's say at 20-30%, we will become profitable and we'll continue to try and scale and figure if we can create a valuable company. If not, that's fine. But at least there is a material skin in the game from the founder and the management team that I think that's a good signal, if you ask me, for investors. Yeah. So we don't know this situation, but I'm sure the discussions are happening basis that itself, right? Like, how kicked is everyone about the core business? Or are there green shoots in the multiple other businesses that they are trying, where they believe that, you know, while the core business slows down to, let's say, 10-20% growth year on year, the new businesses will start ramping up the revenue and the group fundamentally then again starts growing at 30-40% year on year.
I think Avnish shared that chart, right? Where while India has seen a lot of venture capital getting returned because, or at least the potential to get returned because of companies going public, there's equally a dearth of companies going public in the US, which has really screwed up the venture capital returns, the cash flows of VCs in a sense, because, you know, when you're investing, you're investing out of a fund. So let's say your 10 years of your fund is done, you need to return that capital and you need to draw down capital for your next fund. So if your 2015 fund is ending in 2025, you need to return capital by 2025 and you may launch your fund. So 2015, let's say, was your first fund, 2018 could be your second fund, 2021 could be, let's say, the third fund, and 2024 would be the fourth fund. So you're going to the LP and asking money for the fourth, but you need to return fund one money by then, right? And if you're not returning it, how does the guy support you for fund four? Because you were supposed to, I mean, in a very simple thing terms, think of it like a loan, right? You're going and asking for a fresh loan, but you have not returned what you were supposed to return by this time. So it becomes very difficult for people to believe that you will continue to perform. And that is something that's happening in the US today, where effectively the net cash flow for VCs is negative for the last couple of years. And I think it will continue to be negative in 2024 as well. All because M&As have stopped. There's a significant slowdown in mergers and acquisitions in the US. And IPOs have been very, very scarce because the pricing of IPOs would be much lower than the last private round. Like we saw MobiQuick take a haircut and just go in for the IPO at 1/4 the price of the last round. In fact, what was the company in the US, Chirag, that went IPO 2 weeks back in a similar situation? Was it CrowdStrike? They also went IPO at half the price of the last round valuation. But the IPO has done well. And there's a lot of push now from VCs to get these companies listed just to make sure that liquidity is available for their LPs. Without which, it's going to be hard for them to continue to raise their next funds and continue to deploy. So it's an interesting situation that last happened so poorly only during the time of the great financial crisis in 2008-09. A slight dip in 17-18, but sustained dip has not been seen for so long. And three continuous years of negative cash flow is quite worrying for US venture capital.